Listening test. Task 1. You are going to listen to a recording about how a famous sports competition first started. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences, 1 to 7, with the sentence endings, A to J. There are two sentence endings that you should not use. Write your answers in the boxes provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
It was whilst competing in a triathlon event in San Diego in 1974 that American couple John and Judy Collins first became fascinated by the desire to push themselves and others to the limit. But the couple who would go on to create the legendary Ironman competition are probably the most unlikely founders. John was a US naval officer stationed in Hawaii, but he wasn't the fittest of servicemen.
I was in the least outdoorsy part of the Navy there could possibly be. I was on a nuclear submarine, and I was smoking 3 packages of cigarettes a day and drinking 20 cups of coffee a day and sleeping about 4 hours a night underwater for 120 days at a time. And I got asthma and got physically disqualified. And they threw me off submarines. They threw me off of ships.
John eventually transferred to naval engineering duties, which kept him firmly indoors. But living on the stunning and sunny island of Hawaii, the couple's interest in the outdoors and exercise soon increased.
We were both doing a lot of running and a lot of swimming. I was running 5 days a week at least, and we would have one long run on the weekend. We were in good shape, but we were not fast, and we were not genetically gifted to be fast for a distance.
In 1974, John and Judy decided to take part in a new sporting event in San Diego. It involved running, swimming, and cycling, and it was called a triathlon.
It started out with a run, and then a little over 5-mile bike ride, and then 4 legs of running and swimming. So, of course, we are barefoot, we are wearing swimsuits, and we finished in the dark. We thought it was a whole lot of fun. But when we went back to our swim coach 2 nights later and told him what fun it was, he told us it was the stupidest thing he'd ever heard of because it wasn't a sport.
But although some thought the idea of a triathlon was a bit crazy, it captured John and Judy's imagination.
John was thinking more, who's the better athlete, runners or swimmers? And other people that we mentioned triathlon to started calculating how much swimming was the same amount of aerobic work as doing a marathon and all the other distances. And we ended up discussing it one night.
It was during an awards banquet for the Waikiki Swim Club that John and Judy thought up a challenge that would settle these arguments and test the toughest of athletes. They designed a race that would combine a 2.4-mile swim, a 112-mile cycle ride, and the full 26.2 miles of a running marathon. Whoever came out on top would be dubbed the Iron Man.
I was stationed at the Naval Shipyard at Pearl Harbor, and among the shipyard runners, there was a Japanese man who ran and ran and ran. It didn't make any difference whether it was a short distance or a long distance. He ran the same speed, and he was nicknamed the Iron Man. And so we said, whoever finishes this thing first, we can call that person the Iron Man.
We all wanted to be the Iron Man. We wanted to have the feeling of going on all day long and not getting tired. And that's what we hoped would happen in this event.
So the first Ironman was staged on Oahu, one of the smaller Hawaiian islands, on a very stormy day in 1978. But it wasn't making headlines yet, and there was a reason for that.
And low profile. The last line in the announcement said, if nobody is hurt or killed, and we don't have any trouble with the legal authorities, we'll do it again next year.
And the first Ironman was also a rather select affair.
The first year, 18 showed up, 15 started, and 12 finished.
The very first Ironman was Gordon Haller, who completed the course in 11 hours, 46 minutes, and 58 seconds. It took John 17 hours. So many years on, and much of it is now a blur. But he remembers it being a tough but exhilarating experience.
I was number 9, so I get to claim that in 1 year, I was in the top 10 worldwide in Ironman.
So Ironman was born, and John and Judy set about organising the next one. It was whilst competing in a triathlon event in San Diego in 1974 that American couple John and Judy Collins first became fascinated by the desire to push themselves and others to the limit. But the couple who would go on to create the legendary Ironman competition are probably the most unlikely founders. John was a US naval officer stationed in Hawaii, but he wasn't the fittest of servicemen.
I was in the least outdoorsy part of the Navy there could possibly be. I was on a nuclear submarine, and I was smoking 3 packages of cigarettes a day and drinking 20 cups of coffee a day and sleeping about 4 hours a night underwater for 120 days at a time, and I got asthma and got physically disqualified. And they threw me off submarines, they threw me off of ships.
John eventually transferred to naval engineering duties, which kept him firmly indoors. But living on the stunning and sunny island of Hawaii, the couple's interest in the outdoors and exercise soon increased.
We were both doing a lot of running and a lot of swimming. I was running 5 days a week at least, and we would have one long run on the weekend. We were in good shape, but we were not fast, and we were not genetically gifted to be fast for a distance.
In 1974, John and Judy decided to take part in a new sporting event in San Diego. It involved running, swimming, and cycling, and it was called a triathlon.
It started out with a run, and then a little over 5 mile bike ride, and then 4 legs of running and swimming. So, of course, we are barefoot, we are wearing swimsuits, and we finished in the dark. We thought it was a whole lot of fun. But when we went back to our swim coach 2 nights later and told him what fun it was, he told us it was the stupidest thing he'd ever heard of because it wasn't a sport.
But although some thought the idea of a triathlon was a bit crazy, it captured John and Judy's imagination.
John was thinking more, who's the better athlete, runners or swimmers? And other people that we mentioned triathlon to started calculating how much swimming was the same amount of aerobic work as doing a marathon and all the other distances. And we ended up discussing it one night.
It was during an awards banquet for the Waikiki Swim Club that John and Judy thought up a challenge that would settle these arguments and test the toughest of athletes. They designed a race that would combine a 2.4-mile swim, a 112-mile cycle ride, and the full 26.2 miles of a running marathon. Whoever came out on top would be dubbed the Iron Man.
I was stationed at the Naval Shipyard at Pearl Harbor, and among the shipyard runners, there was a Japanese man who ran and ran and ran. It didn't make any difference whether it was a short distance or a long distance. He ran the same speed, and he was nicknamed the Iron Man. And so we said, whoever finishes this thing first, we can call that person the Iron Man.
We all wanted to be the Iron Man. We wanted to have the feeling of going on all day long and not getting tired. And that's what we hoped would happen in this event.
So the first Ironman was staged on Oahu, one of the smaller Hawaiian islands, on a very stormy day in 1978. But it wasn't making headlines yet, and there was a reason for that.
And low profile. The last line in the announcement said, if nobody is hurt or killed, And we don't have any trouble with the legal authorities. We'll do it again next year.
And the first Ironman was also a rather select affair.
The first year, 18 showed up, 15 started, and 12 finished.
The very first Ironman was Gordon Haller, who completed the course in 11 hours, 46 minutes, and 58 seconds. It took John 17 hours. So many years on, and much of it is now a blur. But he remembers it being a tough but exhilarating experience.
I was number 9, so I get to claim that in 1 year, I was in the top 10 worldwide in Ironman.
So Ironman was born, and John and Judy set about organising the next one.
Task 2. You are going to listen to a talk by an astronomer, Lucianne Walkowitz. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, answer the questions 1 to 9 using a maximum of 4 words. Write your answers in the spaces provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Here's Lucianne Walkowitz. We're at a tipping point in human history, a species poised between gaining the stars and losing the planet we call home. Even in just the past few years, we've greatly expanded our knowledge of how Earth fits within the context of our universe. NASA's Kepler mission has discovered thousands of potential planets around other stars, indicating that Earth is but one of billions of planets in our galaxy. Kepler is a space telescope that measures the subtle dimming of stars as planets pass in front of them, blocking just a little bit of that light from reaching us. Kepler's data reveals planet sizes, as well as their distance from their parent star. Together, this helps us understand whether these planets are small and rocky, like the terrestrial planets in our own solar system, and also how much light they receive from their parent sun. In turn, this provides clues as to whether these planets that we discover might be habitable or not. Unfortunately, at the same time as we're discovering this treasure trove of potentially habitable worlds, our own planet is sagging under the weight of humanity. 2014 was the hottest year on record. Glaciers and sea ice that have been with us for millennia are now disappearing in a matter of decades. These planetary-scale environmental changes that we have set in motion are rapidly outpacing our ability to alter their course. But I'm not a climate scientist. I'm an astronomer. I study planetary habitability as influenced by stars, with the hopes of finding the places in the universe where we might discover life beyond our own planet. You could say that I look for choice alien real estate. Now, as somebody who is deeply embedded in the search for life in the universe, I can tell you that the more you look for planets like Earth, the more you appreciate our own planet itself. Each one of these new worlds invites a comparison between the newly discovered planet and the planets we know best, those of our own solar system. Consider our neighbor, Mars. Mars is small and rocky, and though it's a bit far from the sun, it might be considered a potentially habitable world if found by a mission like Kepler. Indeed, it's possible that Mars was habitable in the past. And in part, this is why we study Mars so much. Our rovers, like Curiosity, crawl across its surface, scratching for clues as to the origins of life as we know it. Orbiters like the MAVEN mission sample the Martian atmosphere, trying to understand how Mars might have lost its past habitability. Private space flight companies now offer not just a short trip to near space, but the tantalizing possibility of living our lives on Mars. But though these Martian vistas resemble the deserts of our own homeworld, places that are tied in our imagination to ideas about pioneering and frontiers, compared to Earth, Mars is a pretty terrible place to live. Consider the extent to which we have not colonized the deserts of our own planet, places that are lush by comparison with Mars. Even in the driest, highest places on Earth, the air is sweet and thick with oxygen, exhaled from thousands of miles away by our rainforests. I worry that this excitement about colonizing Mars and other planets carries with it a long, dark shadow. The implication and belief by some that Mars will be there to save us from the self-inflicted destruction of the only truly habitable planet we know of, the Earth. As much as I love interplanetary exploration, I deeply disagree with this idea. There are many excellent reasons to go to Mars, but for anyone to tell you that Mars will be there to back up humanity is like the captain of the Titanic telling you that the real party is happening later on the lifeboats.
Here's Lucianne Walkowitz.
We're at a tipping point in human history, a species poised between gaining the stars and losing the planet we call home. Even in just the past few years, we've greatly expanded our knowledge of how Earth fits within the context of our universe. NASA's Kepler mission has discovered thousands of potential planets around other stars, indicating that Earth is but one of billions of planets in our galaxy. Kepler's a space telescope that measures the subtle dimming of stars as planets pass in front of them, blocking just a little bit of that light from reaching us. Kepler's data reveals planet sizes, as well as their distance from their parent star. Together, this helps us understand whether these planets are small and rocky, like the terrestrial planets in our own solar system, and also how much light they receive from their parent sun. In turn, this provides clues as to whether these planets that we discover might be habitable or not. Unfortunately, at the same time as we're discovering this treasure trove of potentially habitable worlds, our own planet is sagging under the weight of humanity. 2014 was the hottest year on record. Glaciers and sea ice that have been with us for millennia are now disappearing in a matter of decades. These planetary-scale environmental changes that we have set in motion are rapidly outpacing our ability to alter their course. But I'm not a climate scientist. I'm an astronomer. I study planetary habitability as influenced by stars, with the hopes of finding the places in the universe where we might discover life beyond our own planet. You could say that I look for choice alien real estate. Now, as somebody who is deeply embedded in the search for life in the universe, I can tell you that the more you look for planets like Earth, the more you appreciate our own planet itself. Each one of these new worlds invites a comparison between the newly discovered planet and the planets we know best, those of our own solar system. Consider our neighbor, Mars. Mars is small and rocky, and though it's a bit far from the sun, it might be considered a potentially habitable world if found by a mission like Kepler. Indeed, it's possible that Mars was habitable in the past. And in part, this is why we study Mars so much. Our rovers, like Curiosity, crawl across its surface, scratching for clues as to the origins of life as we know it. Orbiters like the MAVEN mission sample the Martian atmosphere, trying to understand how Mars might have lost its past habitability. Private space flight companies now offer not just a short trip to near space, but the tantalizing possibility of living our lives on Mars. But though these Martian vistas resemble the deserts of our own homeworld, places that are tied in our imagination to ideas about pioneering and frontiers. Compared to Earth, Mars is a pretty terrible place to live. Consider the extent to which we have not colonized the deserts of our own planet, places that are lush by comparison with Mars. Even in the driest, highest places on Earth, the air is sweet and thick with oxygen, exhaled from thousands of miles away by our rainforests. I worry that this excitement about colonizing Mars and other planets carries with it a long, dark shadow. The implication and belief by some that Mars will be there to save us from the self-inflicted destruction of the only truly habitable planet we know of, the Earth. As much as I love interplanetary exploration, I deeply disagree with this idea. There are many excellent reasons to go to Mars, but for anyone to tell you that Mars will be there to back up humanity is like the captain of the Titanic telling you that the real party is happening later on the lifeboats.
Task 3. You are going to listen to a broadcast about cocoa. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer, A, B, C, or D, for each question, 1 to 8. Put a cross in the correct box on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
With around a third of the world's cocoa crop lost to pests and diseases every year and demand outstripping supply, you may have heard or seen dire warnings recently that the world had hit peak cocoa and we're heading towards a global chocolate meltdown. Just imagine. But fear not, according to Professor Paul Hadley from the International Cocoa Quarantine Centre, his job is to keep our cocoa supply safe for the moment. From an unlikely base in a greenhouse in Reading in England, he's trying to safeguard the future of the world's cocoa and chocolate supply.
It's very much a subsistence crop grown in the humid tropics. And if you can visualise it, it's probably at the most 1 or 2 acres of cocoa being grown by a smallholder farmer, Ghanaian, Ivorian, with his family, and that's really the level at which cocoa's grown. And that's the level at which about 75%, I should think, of the world's cocoa is produced.
And the actual cocoa bean comes from a cocoa tree, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. The cocoa tree produces pods, and interestingly, the pods are produced on the trunk itself. So, and each pod will contain between 30 and 50 seeds. And they're about the size of a broad bean seed, I should think.
So you're at the International Cocoa Quarantine Centre. What is that exactly? Is it essentially a large greenhouse?
Well, it is a large greenhouse. It's quite a sophisticated greenhouse. We maintain 400 cocoa varieties in as near as we can make it tropical conditions, but also in conditions of very high health status. So there's no pests or diseases around, and we're monitoring material that we're bringing in from one part of the world very closely before we send it out to another part of the world.
Really? So there's this sort of genetic swap happening between continents, for example, from the Americas through to Africa?
Yeah, that's it. So the center of origin of cocoa is in South and Central America. And that's principally where a lot of the new interesting varieties are coming from. And we are passing those varieties, once we're happy that they're free of pests and diseases, on to cocoa producing countries in West Africa, Southeast Asia, and we've sent material to Australia and places like that. So there's a lot of interest in receiving some of this material.
So the Americas is where there's the most genetic diversity within the cocoa species?
Yes, absolutely it is. It's largely in the Amazon rainforest and up towards Central America and places like Belize. So it's that's really where the banks of the rivers in the Amazon and so on and so forth. That's where a lot of the wild cocoa is growing.
And yet today Africa is the big producer of cocoa. What happened? Why has Africa become sort of the powerhouse, the world's sort of cocoa farm? What happened in South America?
It wasn't always that way. In fact, Brazil was one of the most important cocoa producing countries until about 20 years ago. And this just illustrates the dangers of pests and diseases. A disease called witch's broom disease got into the main cocoa producing area in Brazil, and within a matter of just a few years, absolutely destroyed the industry there, so that actually, up to very recently, Brazil was a net importer of cocoa to maintain its own country requirement for confectionery. So West Africa produces about 75% of the world cocoa. But of course, now this is where we become so important. If that disease, witch's broom, got into West Africa.
With around a third of the world's cocoa crop lost to pests and diseases every year and demand outstripping supply, you may have heard or seen dire warnings recently that the world had hit peak cocoa and we're heading towards a global chocolate meltdown. Just imagine. But fear not. According to Professor Paul Hadley from the International Cocoa Quarantine Centre, his job is to keep our cocoa supply safe for the moment. From an unlikely base in a greenhouse in Reading in England, he's trying to safeguard the future of the world's cocoa and chocolate supply.
It's very much a subsistence crop grown in the humid tropics. And if you can visualise it, it's probably at the most 1 or 2 acres of cocoa being grown by a smallholder farmer, Ghanaian, Ivorian, with his family, and that's really the level at which cocoa's grown. And that's the level at which about 75%, I should think, of the world's cocoa is produced.
And the actual cocoa bean comes from a cocoa tree, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. The cocoa tree produces pods, and interestingly, the pods are produced on the trunk itself. So, and each pod will contain between 30 and 50 seeds, and they're about the size of a broad bean seed, I should think.
So you're at the International Cocoa Quarantine Centre. What is that exactly? Is it essentially a large greenhouse?
Well, it is a large greenhouse. It's quite a sophisticated greenhouse. We maintain 400 cocoa varieties in as near as we can make it tropical conditions. but also in conditions of very high health status. So there's no pests or diseases around, and we're monitoring material that we're bringing in from one part of the world very closely before we send it out to another part of the world.
Really? So there's a sort of genetic swap happening between continents, for example, from the Americas through to Africa?
Yeah, that's it. So the center of origin of cocoa is in South and Central America. And that's principally where a lot of the new interesting varieties are coming from. And we are passing those varieties, once we're happy that they're free of pests and diseases, on to cocoa producing countries in West Africa, Southeast Asia, and we've sent material to Australia and places like that. So there's a lot of interest in receiving some of this material.
So the Americas is where there's the most genetic diversity within the cocoa species?
Yes, absolutely it is. It's largely in the Amazon rainforest and up towards Central America and places like Belize. So it's that's really this where the banks of the rivers in the Amazon and so on and so forth. That's where a lot of the wild cocoa is growing.
And yet today Africa is the big producer of cocoa. What happened? Why has Africa become sort of the powerhouse, the world's sort of cocoa farm? What happened in South America?
It wasn't always that way. In fact, Brazil was one of the most important cocoa producing countries until about 20 years ago. And this just illustrates the dangers of pests and diseases. A disease called witch's broom disease got into the main cocoa producing area in Brazil, and within a matter of just a few years, absolutely destroyed the industry there, so that actually, up to very recently, Brazil was a net importer of cocoa to maintain its own country requirement for confectionery. So West Africa produces about 75% of the world cocoa. But of course, now this is where we become so important. If that disease, witch's broom, got into West Africa.
Task 4. You are going to listen to a discussion with experts about helping young people find work. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences, 1 to 7, with the sentence endings, A to J. There are two sentence endings that you should not use. Write your answers in the boxes provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Here in the UK, almost 23% of 16 to 24-year-olds are currently out of work. The press has labelled them the lost generation. And while that may be a touch melodramatic, the core problem is a very real one. Last year, in response, the government published the Youth Contract, a package of ideas designed to tackle short-term youth unemployment. But there are bigger and more structural workforce problems hampering young people's progression in the working world. And according to the CIPD, it's not just government and the education system who should take the lead on making changes, but employers as well. Now, to discuss what employers could or indeed should be doing to play their part in boosting work opportunities for young people, I'm joined by the CIPD's own expert in the field, Katerina Rudiger. We also have with us Jane Daly, who's Head of Learning and Development for Marks & Spencer's 14 head office business units, and Liz Eddy, who's Head of Skills for NHS Employers and a firm believer that young people should be seen as the lifeblood of any organisation. Now, Katerina, should we kick off by looking at the data first? We've got unemployment in Europe. It's ranging from about 9% in the Netherlands to 50% in Spain, Greece, Portugal. UK's about in the middle of the range. But these are exceptional times, aren't they? We're towards the end, at the end of a very severe economic cycle. How worried should we be?
Yes, Philippa, I think what you said earlier in your introduction, that there are some structural reasons for youth unemployment continuing being so high, is the issue we need to be concerned with. So while this is obviously important to focus on short-term issues, we need to look at the underlying reasons. And one of the reasons we've explored within our Learning to Work program over the past year or so is really employer behaviour. And we've seen that employer behaviour is really, really crucial in terms of managing education to work transitions. And what we've seen is that employers are often reluctant to employ young person, in particular if they're between the age of 16 and 18. And I think generally what we see as well is that employers prefer to recruit somebody with experience who can, you know, to use the expression, hit the ground running. And that's something that really disadvantages young people in the labour market because they obviously don't really have that experience.
So we've got two issues just to kick off. We've got a lack of employable work-ready candidates and a certain reluctance among a lot of employers to take on young people when they could take on someone older, more experienced, more work-ready.
Exactly, that's right.
Now, Jane, I know M&S targets youngsters. Why do you do that?
From an M&S perspective, young people are very important to our organisation. They're customers, for a start. But the most important thing is they really do bring, as Katerina said, a sustainable approach to our workforce planning. They are going to be our workforce of the future.
So it's a commercial imperative for you?
Absolutely.
I mean, I take the point that, you know, that you're starting off a talent pipeline with young people. And indeed, of course, young people are cheaper to employ. But they do lack skills, they lack experience. So there's a cost attached to this, isn't there?
There is a cost. I mean, there's a cost to any new employee, anybody new that we employ. But from a young person's perspective, they often need more support and something like a buddy or a mentor when they get going. And that's something that we do very well at M&S, so that we offer experience for these people, but with support, so it doesn't affect our customers and our business.
Liz, I mean, obviously the NHS is a massive employer, but the job market has structurally changed in recent decades, hasn't it? Here in the UK, almost 23% of 16 to 24-year-olds are currently out of work. The press has labelled them the lost generation. And while that may be a touch melodramatic, the core problem is a very real one. Last year, in response, the government published the Youth Contract, a package of ideas designed to tackle short-term youth unemployment. But there are bigger and more structural workforce problems hampering young people's progression in the working world. And according to the CIPD, it's not just government and the education system who should take the lead on making changes, but employers as well. Now, to discuss what employers could or indeed should be doing to play their part in boosting work opportunities for young people, I'm joined by the CIPD's own expert in the field, Katerina Rudiger. We also have with us Jane Daly, who's Head of Learning and Development for Marks & Spencer's 14 head office business units, and Liz Eddy, who's head of skills for NHS employers and a firm believer that young people should be seen as the lifeblood of any organisation. Now, Catherine, should we kick off by looking at the data first? We've got unemployment in Europe. It's ranging from about 9% in the Netherlands to 50% in Spain, Greece, Portugal. UK is about in the middle of the range. But these are exceptional times, aren't they? We're towards the end, at the end of a very severe economic cycle. How worried should we be?
Yes, Philippa, I think what you said earlier in your introduction, that there are some structural reasons for youth unemployment continuing being so high, is the issue we need to be concerned with. So while this is obviously important to focus on short-term issues, we need to look at the underlying reasons. And one of the reasons we've explored within our Learning to Work program over the past year or so is really employer behaviour. And we've seen that employer behaviour is really, really crucial in terms of managing education to work transitions. And what we've seen is that employers are often reluctant to employ a young person, in particular if they're between the age of 16 and 18. And I think generally what we see as well is that employers prefer to recruit somebody with experience who can, you know, to use the expression, hit the ground running. And that's something that really disadvantages young people in the labour market because they obviously don't really have that experience.
So we've got two issues just to kick off. We've got a lack of employable work-ready candidates and a certain reluctance among a lot of employers to take on young people when they could take on someone older, more experienced, more work-ready.
Exactly, that's right.
Now, Jane, I know M&S targets youngsters. Why do you do that?
From an M&S perspective, young people are very important to our organisation. They're customers, for a start. But the most important thing is they really do bring, as Katerina said, a sustainable approach to our workforce planning. They are going to be our workforce of the future.
So it's a commercial imperative for you?
Absolutely.
I mean, I take the point that, you know, that you're starting off your talent pipeline with young people. And indeed, of course, young people are cheaper to employ. But they do lack skills, they lack experience. So there's a cost attached to this, isn't there?
There is a cost. I mean, there's a cost to any new employee, anybody new that we employ. But from a young person's perspective, they often need more support and something like a buddy or a mentor when they get going. And that's something that we do very well at M&S, so that we offer experience for these people, but with support, so it doesn't affect our customers and our business.
Liz, I mean, obviously the NHS is a massive employer, but the job market has structurally changed in recent decades, hasn't it?
This is the end of the listening test.